I'm Dr. Fiona Lovely, and this is the Not Your Mother's Menopause podcast. I'm taking the taboos of menopause and perimenopause and bringing light to the dark. No bullshit, no shame. It's time for us to gain a new paradigm in female health, out with the old and in with the new, and I'm bringing fresh perspectives from someone in the arena. I've been practicing women's health for nearly 20 years, and I'm spilling the tea on what it means to live at midlife, knowing that the best is yet to come. I'm sharing my Gen X approach to living through this transition, sassy, a bit sweary, and always honest. Tactical tips and instantly usable information is my aim. I hope to make you laugh and that you learn something new that helps you embrace the change. Together, we bring power to the peri. Onward to the podcast. This is the Not Your Mother's Menopause podcast, and I'm Dr. Fiona Lovely, and today I'm interviewing fellow Canadian Natalie McLean. Natalie McLean, named the world's best drinks journalist, has also won 4 James Beard Foundation Journalism Awards. She's the best-selling author of Red, White, and Drunk All Over. Her new memoir, Wine Witch on Fire, Rising from the Ashes of Divorce, Defamation, and Drinking Too Much, has just become a national bestseller and has been described as, quote, this decade's Eat, Pray, Love, end quote. She hosts the New York Times recommended podcast, Unreserved Wine Talk, and offers popular online wine and food pairing classes at nataliemclean.com. She calls herself an online wine educator, podcaster, award-winning journalist, and author. She has 3 books, and man, did we have a great conversation. So Natalie was kind enough to send me Wine Witch on Fire, which I've been reading the last couple of months, and I love it. It's a great book. It truly is in the style of Eat, Pray, Love. And I was very aware, though I was reading this very entertaining book, that reads like a novel, it actually is the story of Natalie's life or a chapter of Natalie's life. And I would just like to say, Natalie is a wordsmith. Her writing is exquisite. It's just so well done. Please read Wine Witch on Fire. Now, we had a conversation that went far beyond the book. We talked about how at midlife, women often find ourselves drinking too much, and wine seems to be a very popular thing that we like to drink. And what does it mean? Does it mean anything? Should we be concerned about it? And if we are concerned about it, how do we go about changing that habit? And Natalie shares her own experience with this, and she gives the tips she has found the most useful, some of them she got from her therapist, on how to get a grip on drinking. Wine is her life. It's her job. She had to make a choice about, does she quit cold turkey or does she continue to drink, but in a controlled fashion? It was a really very, very interesting conversation. I call Natalie my new friend. When she said, we use wine to forget and relax. Oh man. I was like, I feel a little seen right here. So we talked about the casual drinking experience at midlife. We talked about low and no alcohol wines. And are they an appropriate, like for me, I love the taste of wine, but wine with the alcohol was disrupting my sleep and making me feel just generally crummy. So I had to stop drinking it. But could I get the taste experience of the wines I love from low and no alcohol wines? And Natalie fills us in on that, which was so interesting to talk about. And, you know, speaking of that, women that have difficulties with the effects of wine, is it a sulfites problem? Is it an alcohol problem? Or is it a histamine problem? Some people are genuinely allergic to alcohol, to histamines, maybe to sulfites as well. But Natalie had some really interesting insights on the whole sulfites discussion. So please tune in and listen to this really interesting conversation I recently had with Natalie McLean, author and online wine educator. Please find out more about Natalie on her website, nataliemclean.com, on Instagram at Natalie McLean Wine, and of course, on her podcast, Unreserved Wine Talk. Please enjoy this conversation between the two of us. And before you do that, just take a moment to listen to what our sponsor has to share. It's important to me that the supplements I use are of the highest quality, and that's why for more than 3 years, I've been drinking AG1. It is researched and developed by an in-house team of scientists, doctors, and nutritionists with decades of experience in their respective fields. Quality for AG1 isn't just a buzzword. It's a commitment backed by expert-led scientific research, high-quality ingredients, and rigorous testing. I know I can trust what's in every scoop of AG1 because they obsess over product quality, the standards of manufacturing partners, and sustainable practices. It's easy and fast to use. Drinking AG1 mixed with water in one scoop a day covers my nutritional bases. Prebiotics, probiotics, digestive enzymes for gut support, B vitamins and rhodiola for energy support, folate, magnesium, and ashwagandha for stress support, and vitamin C and zinc for my immune health. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D plus K2 and 5 free travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/FionaLovely. That's drinkag1.com/FionaLovely. Okay, everybody, welcome to the Not Your Mother's Menopause podcast. I'm Dr. Fiona Lovely, and I have the pleasure of interviewing Natalie McLean today, journalist, author, podcaster, and online wine educator. Oh my God, welcome to the show.
It is so great to be here with you, Fiona. I am a big fan of your podcast, as you know, not just saying, and have been binge listening, not binge drinking, binge listening to your back episodes.
We'll get to that other part later.
So good. Yeah, exactly. Part two.
Thank you. Thank you, Natalie. That's so kind. I so appreciate it. So I was thrilled to get your email and even more excited to get this wonderful book that you've just written. And for those of you that can't see it, I'm holding it up on the video recording. I almost said tape, Natalie. Wine Witch on Fire, it's called. And the subtitle is Rising from the Ashes of Divorce, Defamation, and Drinking Too Much.
I know, it's brought to you by all the dismal D's in that subtitle, eh? My publisher said, if you add one more D, like depression or delirium or destitution, we can't sell this book, so stop it right now. But it is my story.
I love it. I love it. And it reads like a novel.
Thank you.
Have you had people tell you that?
Yes. Yes, I have. And I love that for a couple of reasons, Fiona. First of all, memoir, as you probably know, has more in common with the techniques of fiction than it does with nonfiction. So my first two books were nonfiction. They were about wine. But this one was a whole new genre, a whole new animal I kind of had to learn. Of course, the story, a memoir, is the truth as you know it, as you tell it. It is not fiction. But techniques like plot development, characters, you know, the storyline, all the rest of it, it has to read like a novel to carry the reader through. Because, you know, I mean, there might be a few people like my mother and so on who are actually interested in my story, but more people read a memoir to find their own story in yours.
Wow. I mean, you said a mouthful there, and I found myself in a lot of these pages.
I think
that women reading it will find themselves. And you and I have a lot to unpack around this story. And ultimately, bringing you on the show, we should talk about women and wine at menopause. Mm. This is a big conversation, and we're here to have the discussion so that we can walk informed into this time and also drop a lot of the self-judgment that we have around this topic, right?
Amen. So, yes, exactly.
it's like we scan the horizon looking for the next thing to feel shitty about. Let's just stop all of that.
Please. That's true. Please. Yes. Life's hard enough. Let's just, give ourselves a break.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So I want to read a quote from your book, if that's all right with you.
And absolutely.
I think would be a great place for us to just start talking about it, because in this book, there's a lot of themes that I found surprising. And yes, it reads like a novel, and it left me aghast a lot of times. So here's the quote from page 90, in case anybody's following along. And Natalie's talking to us about wine and women. She says, "We're wallets, not women. We drink cutesy, crappy wines that subsidize the good stuff men drink. Wine was, and still is, the culturally accepted modern day Valium for women stressed out with our faces, bodies, spouses, kids, careers, and homework, housework. It's all over Instagram. Vino is the ultimate soft filter to blunt all of those feels. Don't have time for meditation and yoga? Calm your central nervous system with this Cabernet. Wineries offer vino, vinyasa, yoga classes, detox, then retox. There's a coloring book called My Mummy Drinks Wine and a woman's wine bar with a play space for kids. All fun and games until it's time to drive the kiddos home." Wow. Women and wine, it's a very different conversation than if we're talking about men and wine.
It
I had
is.
no idea that the wine industry was so misogynistic. Tell
Yeah,
us.
neither did I, in terms of going into this industry, but I'm awake now. But we're talking about the marketing aspect here, Fiona, which I found fascinating because before I got into the wine world, I was in high tech and business. So my marketing brain sort of lit up when I started looking at all the messages in wine marketing. And the message on the bottle to me sometimes is that we're either babes or battle axes. There's nothing in between. So you either see wines marketed, with red lips and short dresses and high stilettos, or else, we're just, well, there's a brand called Mad Housewife, and it's for obliviating another day of exhausted motherhood, or, especially the sandwich generation when we're taking care of elderly parents and those who left the nest and came back or whatever they're doing. So, it's playing off all of those themes. And at first I thought, am I just being uptight, kind of a downer by not finding these funny? But I think if we dig down into the messages beyond the LOL social media memes, there's another message there on these labels that, as I say, profit from powerlessness. And that is, no one's thanking mom, so mom will thank herself with a drink, and then another one, and then another one. There's a bitter aftertaste in that kind of marketing and that kind of message. And so I just wanted to kind of point out some of these things that sometimes just go by and we're not even noticing. I am still a proponent of enjoying wine. I still write about it. I still love it. But when there are so many authentic stories about different people who make wine, women, non-binary persons, and so on, why do we need to keep buying bottles with pink bow ties or ribbons and bows or whatever it is?
Wow. You say something else in the book. You say, "Mummy drinks wine because you cry." Wow. Again, it's like a dialogue onto the what women are experiencing, and we're really starting to shine a light into these places where, there's not equality. Even for those of us privileged white women having this conversation
Yes.
here in beautiful Canada, right?
Exactly.
So, tell me what else you've seen that horrifies you when it comes to this very subject, because I really want you to shine a light. So we no longer are doing that. We're saying we're not buying the battle axe wine or the
Sure.
sexy little stiletto wine.
Exactly. And, we vote with our dollars as consumers and as women. That's where we have our power. We still buy 80% of household goods because, for better or worse, we're still tend to be the household shoppers, the social planners, the travel planners, and so on. Women buy 80% of wine. We drink 66% of it, which might surprise some people because wine connoisseurship is there's been a picture painted of an old guy in a smoking jacket with a cigar. But actually, it's women who are the major consumers. It's just the way that we're marketed to is very different from the way wine is marketed to men. No one asks a man why he wants a drink. He has one because he wants one. Yet for women, the message on the bottle seems to be, well, it should be a fancy occasion, girls' night out, you're going to the spa with your besties. And again, I'm not against pairing wine with all of that fun. It's just there's an underlying message that says you better have a reason or permission to drink. And then on the other hand, drink so that, you know, you can feel like you're rewarding yourself somehow. And I think that word reward or deserve, it's often mentioned in addiction literature. And it, again, it gets at that underlying darker message. So those are the kinds of themes that I've dug up during my journey. And then sort of counterbalancing that are all these fabulous, I tended to focus on the stories of women who make wine and the amazing things that they're doing, not only making fabulous wines, but what they've had to overcome in the industry to get there. You know, because fewer than 10% of wineries in North America, both Canada and the US, are owned by women. Women are in the lower ranks, but in terms of ownership, there's still a big imbalance there.
Wow. I did hear you speak recently about the new taxes on wine in Canada and how that really is very incredibly punitive, especially for these small wineries. And we have wonderful wines here in Canada. I think a lot of people just don't even realize that.
Exactly. You know, that most wineries, again, both in Canada and the US, have fewer than 20 employees. And so in wine, in the wine world, small is good because yes. It means artisanal and boutique-y and local, if you want to support local family-owned farms. So the government, not to go off on a sidetrack here, but the government is sort of taxing Canadian wine as though it's a foreign import and like tobacco. I think there's a difference, but that, again, is a whole other discussion. But mm-hmm. in any case, what makes wine wonderful is that attention to small plots and artisanal boutique quality. But again, that smallness also in the wine industry can manifest as there are some structural things that happen with small businesses in that the mentor relationships tend to be one-on-one. So if you're trying to be a winemaker or a sommelier or whatever you're trying to do in this industry, it tends to be one-on-one, often with a older, senior man with a great power imbalance, and you're very dependent on his referral for your next job. Now, I should just at this point do my disclaimer that I do not dislike men. My son is 25. I love him. I've found a new partner since this story took place. We've been together 10 years. My grandfather was pivotal in my life, and my mother and I have even developed an acronym for when I get back a review on Wine Witch on Fire from a man. We just exchange emails and say, AGM, another good man. We are counting them. No, but there's plenty. And there's yes. men who've read this book and appreciate it from the perspective of they have wives and mothers and daughters and so on. But of course, the majority of readers who are reading this book are middle-aged women, because we've been there, we've seen it, we've done it, even if it's not, the situation isn't exactly the same. I think the themes and feelings are.
Yes, absolutely. So having read Wine Witch on Fire, I know that you talk about having come to a point where you realized you were drinking too much wine.
Yes.
Can you talk about that a little bit, please?
Absolutely. So 2012, I call my no good, terrible, very bad vintage, when both my personal and professional lives sort of went up in flames. And it started with my husband of 20 years asking for a divorce out of the blue. That blindsided me. I thought everything was going just fine and that we had settled into contented companionship. And then it ended with an online mobbing on social media from some rival writers who, surprise, surprise, we're all older white men. Anyway, but in response to those two events, I started drinking too much. I'd been writing about wine for 14 years before this happened. Never a problem. During that year, the depression from the divorce and the anxiety from the online mobbing, I was just reaching out to something that was very much available to me. I mean, my friends... They used to joke about the fact I get deliveries of wine almost every day to my doorstep from wineries, from wine agencies, and they're always asking, what are you doing with those leftovers? So the wine was not only very much available to me, but also I had the professional mantle of respectability. If you saw a glass in my hand, a glass of wine in my hand at noon, I must be writing an article or pairing it with something. You know, I could drink any time I wanted to without having to make any excuses. So all of that coalesced into realizing that it was becoming a problem. And there were various telltale signs. Like I had this weird split between professional and personal wine, which is a good thing if you drink for a living. I taste for a living. I tell my online course students, actually, the difference between tasting and drinking is spitting and thinking. It's like, so don't think you're just downing it all to be thorough. They all are very keen students. But it's like when a movie critic goes to the movies and like they're making notes versus when the movie critic goes to a movie and they're not writing a review for the paper, wherever their outlet is. It's like that with wine. So my personal wine consumption was creeping up earlier and earlier into the day. It had been about 6 p.m. Now it's creeping back to 4 p.m. I was drinking more. You know, there's always that telltale sign when you start falling asleep on the sofa at 7. But really, you know, I think often there's a bottoming out kind of moment. Fortunately, mine did not have any physical harm. But, you know, I just, it had to do with shame. And, you know, my new partner and I, what is he in the book? Daniel was his name. I started calling him Daniel midway through the book and said, I told him, you're becoming a real character in my life. And he just rolled his eyes. But anyway, I know this all sounds like a very dark story, but there is a lot of humor in it. I can't resist or help myself. So,
and can I just say, you are a fantastic writer.
Thank you.
So good.
Oh,
so many
Fiona,
beautiful,
thank you.
Beautiful turns of phrase. Please read this book, people. It's so good.
Oh,
Natalie, I know she educates on wine, but really she's a writer. That's her soul. I could just see
it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Yeah. You know, taking off on a sidetrack, I never had the confidence to write, Fiona, until I completed a sommelier program just for fun at night. And then I thought, gee, wine could be my way, my hook, you know, in order to pitch publications. I never thought I could earn a living as a writer. So anyway, wine gave me that excuse, reason, whatever.
Because what could be complicated about wine?
Read the book, people.
Read the damn book. Wine Witch on Fire.
Then I could retreat into geek speak and all the rest of it. Yes, I'm an authority now. So pay me. Yeah, that moment really, to go back to your question, when did I realize I had a problem? All those telltale signs. Plus, it was a moment that involved shame, deep shame for me. Daniel and I were hosting a dinner party. I was not pacing myself. These were good friends. And I'm not exactly sure what time it was, but I wandered off into my office where I had a small little sofa in there. I laid down and fell asleep. And it wasn't until the next morning that I woke up. And I was mortified because I thought, oh my God, I missed the part of the dinner party. I missed them saying goodnight. They probably wondered, where did she go? I don't know what I said. And that is the technical definition of blackout. Even when you're awake, if alcohol is overwhelming your brain and you're not remembering parts of your evening, that's a blackout. It's not the same as passing out, but they're highly correlated. So I fell asleep, didn't remember chunks of the evening. And when I got up in the morning, I went to Daniel, who was not pleased, but it wasn't a fight. It was more devastating than a fight because I said, what did they say when they left? And he said nothing. And I was just like, that's worse than if they had been critical or anything else.
Yes.
And I was like this. And I just said to myself, this has to stop. This has to I can't live like this. And yet I didn't want to give up wine either. So it was a difficult path, you know, because some people, the right choice is for them to go sober, completely abstain. And I respect that immensely. But I was trying to find this middle ground so that I didn't give up something I enjoyed so much and my whole career at that point.
Yes, absolutely. Were you in midlife while this was going on?
Oh, full blown. Yes. I just welcome to midlife. You're gonna enjoy this show. Yeah. Woo-hoo. Let's just go for it. Why don't we have a complete meltdown? Why do it in small baby steps? So yes, menopause had just hit, and and it was almost like almost a cliche playbook. My husband, 20 years, he's out. And then the career meltdown, and then let's start drinking too much because I can't figure out anything else to do. I got myself into therapy, and there's all kinds of things that I did, steps that I took to get out of this hole that I had dug myself into. But yeah, and then there was menopause and raging hormones and not knowing what to do with them, and not and a doctor who did not believe in hormone replacement therapy, and just going, I don't know what I'm, she put me on Zoloft when I asked her about HRT. The antidepressant that helped a little bit. And I'm not saying all of this was about hormones, but it sure played a big role in the final blend, if you will.
Yes, absolutely. And what happens to us at this midlife transition is we can get that depression anxiety that rises. It's officially called anhedonia in the literature, and it means essentially a lack of pleasure, a lack of joy.
Right.
Now,
Exactly.
if we know that these things are connected to the egress of estrogen, then why not give women estrogen?
I'm such a big believer. Oh my gosh. And when I got onto your podcast, I thought, oh, finally, someone who's like not saying, oh, it's all bad. And I know it's
No.
individual for everyone and so on and so on. But I read the
Yes.
book Estrogen Matters. And then I
Yes.
looked again at that nurse's study or the big study and the
Yes, the Women's
flaws.
Health Initiative.
And I thought, oh my Lord, because I eventually got on HRT with a different doctor, and it changed my world, my sleep, my mood, everything. It was part of the steps I took to back off on the alcohol. Just, that's far more harmful than for me, I should speak for myself, than, going on HRT, for goodness sakes. I mean, I was medicating myself in the absence of other things.
And the hormones helped you manage the things that had you find yourself over drinking in the first place.
Exactly. It was night and day. It was like, oh, wow. And to the extent, Fiona, it made me wonder if my marriage would not have ended. There were other factors at play in that. But I think if I had anticipated this, if I could have done something proactively, might things have turned out differently? Now, I wouldn't want them to have turned out differently in the end. I mean, with a wonderful man who accepted me, hormone raging hormones and all. Poor man. Truly AGM platinum. But
Yes, he is.
it was just gravy after that. Like after I got my life sorted out and got onto HRT, just everything started to come together really beautifully. Now it's people say, are you okay now? I say, I'm perfect. It's all good. It ended perfectly. It's like, no, I'm still a work in progress. I'm still in therapy. I'll be in therapy till the end of my life. I'm a big proponent of it. And it's every day. Life is a series of decisions. Who do you want to be? And so, but that
Absolutely.
helped a heck of a lot.
Which is great to hear. And I think that will be freeing to a lot of women for you to
Yeah.
say that on the show
Oh, good.
because it does make a huge difference. And we have to remember, I say this quite often to my patients in clinic and certainly on the show as well, is that when we lose the substances in our body that make us accommodating and pleasing to other human beings,
Right.
it changes the dynamics of our relationship. Now, that's not to say that that was the reason why your marriage broke down, right?
Sure.
But it's to say, okay, you have to have that conversation with whoever you're with and say, look, I don't feel like myself. Things are changing. We're going to hang on and figure this out together. Because the thing is, we need to have these conversations far more often as women, number one, because we were all raised to be polite little girls, and that has just messed us up in so many ways.
Yes.
But also, if the relationship is solid, then you grow together, you go through it together. But a lot of women don't want to talk to their spouses about what's happening inside. But what
Yes.
I will tell you is that men are going through their own version of this, and it's
Huh.
even more stigmatized for them.
Wow.
So we all just need to have gentler eyes on each other.
Exactly. And, you know, had I been listening to your podcast back then, if it was, I don't know when exactly when you started, because I'm not right back to episode one yet, but I might have anticipated something like this, because for me, the hormonal changes, in one regard, they were gradual, and in another, I felt like I fell off a cliff, but I never attribute it to estrogen. It's like,
Yep.
oh my. Anyway.
That's how far we are away from the truth in our society when it comes to menopause for women. That's how far we don't automatically think it. And
No.
it's a fascinating conversation. I just in the last 2 weeks saw the first menopause article directed at the millennials.
Wow.
So us Gen X
That's
gals over here going,
great.
yeah, we're experts at it, right? We got this.
Yes. Welcome.
Exactly. And it's such a different conversation than it was for us. I mean,
I'll bet. That's
we're the,
great.
yeah,
Yeah.
agreed. And it was on Oprah's platform in case OprahDaily.com, in case anybody want who's listening to the show wants to be able to go and look at it for yourself. So tell me, let's go back to that moment where you had this event where you were like, okay, I got to get this under control. Can you talk to us a little bit about the steps that you went through in case it's helpful to somebody listening?
I hope it is, because it's become my raison d'être for having this book out in the world, Fiona. The early readers of Wine Witch on Fire, the feedback that I have received that is the strongest are for those who started using the tips in my book. I didn't set out to write a self-help book, but it's become that for a lot of people, actually, because I includes a number of the therapy sessions in the book and the work that I'm doing with my therapist. You can be a fly on the wall, and the things we're working through that are like tactics and strategies. So the first one was dealing with those fundamental issues, the depression from the divorce, the anxiety from the online mobbing, and that work continues, but we really dug into that first. And so dealing with the underlying issues really took the wind out of the wine bag. I don't know. It really reduced
The wine
my
out of the
need,
windbag?
something like this, but it reduced that sort of that agitated, I need a drink, that feeling, and started getting me back to, I'm having a glass of wine because I enjoy it for the sensory pleasure, not because I'm using it to self-medicate. So that was number one, deal with the underlying issues. Number two was a really good thing that she came up with, my therapist. She said, think about what was the thought just before the thought that said, I need a drink. And was it about stress? I'm tired. I'm exhausted. I deserve this treat. Or was it just about, oh, you know, I'm feeling relaxed. I think a glass of wine would be nice with this roast chicken or whatever. And so, always going back one or two thoughts. What was the thought just before the thought that said, I need a drink? That was number two. Number three that people have told me was, of course, pacing, whether it's alternating a glass of water with a glass of wine, introducing low and no alcohol wines. By the way, newsflash, they're really well made. And I've recommended 150 of them, all alcohol-free wines and other drinks on my website. And I can give you some of those if you want for the show notes, Fiona.
Yes, please.
Okay. So introducing those into the mix so that,
Okay.
because we sometimes, for those of us who are introverts and shy, like I am, I have a glass of wine in my hand or something in my hand almost as a nervous tic, especially when I'm in a social situation. I need something to hold on to besides Daniel's thigh, you know, gripping it and going, let's go, please. I can't make any more small talk.
Your social beard.
Exactly. So if you're like that, you know, that can really help, whether it's the low no, the water. Sort of related to this point, I make a game plan now, whether we're enjoying wine here at home, going to a friend's house, or going to a restaurant. So let me do the before and after picture for you. When I was drinking too much, I engaged in what I called delusionally pre-drinking, having a glass of wine before going to the restaurant so that I took my own edge off when we got there and I'd be relaxed and not going, where's the server? Where's the server? I need a glass of wine. But now, what I do is I think, okay, gather myself, whether it's deep breathing or whatever. I'm going to make a plan. I'm going to enjoy 2 glasses of wine, maybe 3. But for me, it's usually 2 to 3 at most. And then I'm going to ask for a chamomile tea so that I still have something. And if they don't have it, I'll ask for something else. I even travel now in my purse with bags of chamomile tea because I find it very calming. There's no caffeine. Yeah, there's no caffeine and you're off the wine. That really helps. And related to this point, you know, Daniel Blessing, he was catching on to this pre-drinking thing, which of course I was sneaking. I had it behind a like cupboard in my office, the glass of wine. And he said, when we get to a restaurant, we're not on the same plane. I want to be on the same plane with you. I want to have the same experience. When you're one drink ahead of me or anyone else, we're not having the same experience. And it was such a loving way to put it. At the time, I called him Buzz Killington, but poor man. Anyway, but it really sunk in that he was coming from a loving place. So there's tips 3 and 4. I can't remember the others, but they might come to me. But those are some of the things that people have found really helpful. I must share one story if I might.
Please.
Actually, okay. So I actually get direct messages and emails almost every day about this book. And they're very moving. And some are light and funny, but others are deeply touching. So I've changed the names, of course. This woman emailed me and she said, this is Susan. And I just want to let you know that John and I lost our 21-year-old son during the pandemic. And John had been hitting the bottle really hard ever since. He read your book and he used some of your tips. And she said, I really believe that is a large part of the reason why he's got his drinking back under control.
Wow.
And yeah, it still gives me goosebumps to even say it. And I thought that's it. That's enough reason for having written this book for me.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. It's so powerful to hear stories like that, isn't it?
It is. It is.
Because you think, how could something that, you know, works for you, how does it work for other people? But you didn't write the book to share those tips. They just happen to be artifactual, if you will, to the story.
That's
and
right.
And yet, so important.
And that's what, you know, I love when people just take what they need from the book. And, you know, if they can find a part of their story in there, you know, like most people, a lot of people may not have been through a divorce, but they've probably, you know, felt loneliness or the longing for love. I hope they have not been mobbed online by a social media gang, but they've probably felt fear or uncertainty or career disappointment. And I think when someone can put those feelings into words for you, it can be very therapeutic, especially if you're reading through the safety of somebody else's story because it didn't happen to you. But you found a release perhaps in the way that those feelings have been articulated. And, you know, for me, it was Glennon Doyle, the memoirist Glennon Doyle, who said, you know, write from a scar, not an open wound. Mm-hmm. And I love that. Mm-hmm. But at the time, my family said, well, your healing is done. Why do you feel the need to publish this story? It's like vandalizing your own privacy. And, you know, for me, poet Sean Doherty had kind of the answer. And he said, because somewhere, someone has a wound in the exact shape of your words.
Mm. Oh, that's beautiful.
Isn't it beautiful?
It really is. It really is. Yeah, there is some merit to exactly what you've said. Don't bleed on the page.
Exactly. Basically. No misery dumps.
Yeah, right. Don't do your processing on the page.
Exactly. Exactly. Right? That's for therapy. Yeah.
Yes. Share a little bit. I think it was Dr. Northrup who counseled me on that one. She said, Dr. Christian Northrup, she said,
wow,
do your healing before you start writing.
Yes.
And I thought, isn't that interesting? Because it's wise. Know for me, when I pick up a book and I open it and I can feel the wound too acutely, it means that it's been written as part of the therapy, right? Which is fine. That will be, as you said, some people will have the wound in the shape of those words. For me, I want to hear how you changed, hear how it changed you, hear the lessons, the extrapolations from your story. That's what I'm interested in.
Exactly. And I think it's Marion Roach, who's a memoir coach, I think. She said, it's not what happened to you, it's what you did with it that matters in a memoir.
I like that. I like that. Okay, so let's talk about casual drinking, because this is, I think, a very interesting conversation to have. I have noticed, I've been in practice 20 years, and I have noticed that since the pandy, my husband and I call it in this house, since the pandy, for sure, there was a lot more drinking that went on. And I even have my own story to share about that before
Yes.
I to add into the mix here.
I'd love to
But
hear it.
because this is part of the conversation, when I meet a new patient, I ask them, do you smoke? Do you drink? If you drink, then how much do you drink? And it's so interesting to see people's reaction to that question, right? It's not dissimilar to asking a woman what she weighs. Yeah. So it's here I am, I'm watching it. And let's just say the container for casual drinking has expanded
Oh,
since the
yes.
pandy. Now, when we got back to work, so in Alberta here, we were shut down for about 2 months. And when we got back to work, I found myself, I'm going to talk about wine here in a minute. I've had to sort of take a diversion away from wine. I love it, but it doesn't love me back. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Sure.
But at the time, it was more of a, I was going through a bourbon phase. I do love bourbon.
Oh,
I
bourbon's
think it's
great.
because it is good. I think it's because I went to school in the States and, dating American men, they like bourbon. So I got kind of used to it. Truth is, I like it. I like it quite a bit. And I would say sometime in that first year, I found myself at the liquor store buying a bottle of bourbon that I know, like a 40, that I know I had bought the same size of bourbon the month before. Now, listen, I'm a super casual drinker. I like the experience of the pleasures of the tasting notes and the smell, and the overconsumption has never been a problem. Binge drinking has never been a problem for me. But if I'm having that every night and it's one every night, then all of a sudden I'm standing in the liquor store and my thought went, here was my wake up moment. My thought went, how am I going to explain to my bookkeeper that I've been at the liquor store buying bourbon twice in the space of a month? And I went, oh yeah, you're probably drinking that too much. So we have our own moments, right?
Absolutely. It's very
We have,
personal, but yeah.
it really, really is. But I know for sure that there are a lot of women in this perimenopausal flux that are using wine to relax, to shut off the overthinking, to, there's a thing that says, okay, well, it helps me sleep. Well, actually, we know now that's not the case. Yeah, it's not the case. It helps you
Right.
relax, but then you wake in the middle of the night because your cortisol and your liver and all of that, right?
At the witching hour of 3 a.m. often, by the time you've metabolized
Yes,
it all.
metabolize. That's right. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on whether you have seen that trend of the uptick of casual drinking around, this massive world event that we've just been through.
Absolutely. And it hasn't recalibrated. So one of the most startling statistics that I read was a study that said during the pandemic, women increased their consumption, I think it was 329% versus before the pandemic started, whereas for the overall population, it was like close to 40%. It was startling in terms of how women had ratcheted up their drinking because, of course, again, often we were taking on new roles, whether it was stay-at-home school teacher or, caregiver or, just even if we had help before for our elderly parents or even our 20-somethings, it all fell on us and it was all there. So the stats have been startling, but even since the pandemic, there's been more studies on how middle-aged women are still drinking too much. We have not recalibrated to pre-pandemic levels. We got a taste for it, I think, and enjoyed drinking and making it a regular habit. And yeah, it is concerning in terms of maybe it's because I've got Google alerts set up on every middle-aged woman drinking, but it just seems there's a study almost every month about women middle-aged and drinking too much, and especially wine. And then for me with the book, it gave permission to my friends and family, and but also women I don't know, emailing me to saying, I've been thinking for a long time that I'm drinking too much. I just either wasn't admitting it to myself or I just didn't want to say it to anyone. But I was kind of becoming a confessor when it came to, oh, well, I can tell her. She's like, been there, done that. But so it has many angles. And then when I started questioning my own overconsumption during 2012, I thought, am I being an enabler for other women who are reading about what I'm doing? Because I'm making it fodder for my humor. You know, my first book was Red, White, and Drunk All Over. The second was Unquenchable. It's kind of a trilogy. The third one, I was sure I was going to end up at a Betty Ford clinic or something, detox center. But so I don't know. It just, I wanted to get away from that too. When I taught, oh, I should add, because, you know, these labels that promote overconsumption to women, I wasn't a bystander in that. I was team captain. I called, you know, my glass of wine at 5 p.m., mommy's little helper. So cute, so funny, but not really. And so I had to reexamine the way I was talking about my overconsumption because I had a public platform. I wrote about wine. I was trying to make it accessible and less intimidating, especially for women. But the way I was doing it in certain aspects, not all, was just encouraging, also encouraging that overconsumption. So it remains an issue. The studies keep coming out. It's something we still need to talk about. And it's something that I'm trying to address with this book and with the conversations it's sparking like between us here.
And I think you do a great job of really shining the light in some of those dark corners.
Thank you.
And I also think that what you've just said about the recalibration, we haven't gone back down despite what we're learning, is a bit of a, it's a window into the misery that women are, that we're dealing with. We really are very, very good at shutting up and putting up. And we shouldn't be that way. Yeah. And I think this is what happens at midlife for us. Once those hormones, those pleasing hormones disappear.
Look out.
Exactly.
All she's sudden, furious.
Exactly. And we have no, sorry. I've just thought of a bunch of like wine label names in my head for the menopausal ladies.
Well, there's actually a label called Nasty Women, which I like actually.
Yes.
And it has all of these women, like Hillary Clinton was on it. She's picked out all of these women, Cheryl Strayed, who wrote the Memoir Wild. And they like one's called Pantsuit something. That was Hillary Clinton's. And then, but it's the Nasty Women line. And I love it because it tells actually the story of each one of these women. They're all in black and white. And so there, you know, there can be real authentic stories, but it does bring out the whole female fury. And, you know, that's why I had the witch theme in there. I think we've been afraid of, you know, we're always the retiring nice girls, the princesses.
The graphic that you've got on the front of this book.
I know, isn't that brilliant? The publisher did such a great job. The fire in the glass.
Fantastic, yes. Yeah. It's so good. Okay, so much to say on what you've just said, but it's true. There's this whole, like, recognition of the fact that we're needing to numb ourselves from the realities that we're living in. And I think that's a really important thing to acknowledge is if you are feeling like you need the experience of relaxation through alcohol instead of just enjoying the wine because you're, you know, interested in being a wine person. I know I've certainly experienced that. Then it's probably time for you to look at it and say, is there something else I should be doing? Is it time for a little therapy? Do I need a vacation? Is there something, you know, relationships get quite fraught at midlife for a lot of women. I guess, you know, it kind of throws this midlife thing kind of throws us up against the doors of all the stuff we haven't dealt with. So if we've been tolerating relationships, this is the moment, right?
Yes.
And so for a lot of women, it's easier to get, you know, pissed. I'm sorry. I should clarify that term because in the United States, that means angry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does.
Which it's a long winter, right?
Yeah.
So in Canada, we say pissed is when someone gets drunk. We say, okay, so someone's going to get inebriated, right? Because they just don't feel good. So is there a gentle container for all of us to say, okay, I'm held, I'm okay. Time to call the therapist, time to call my bestie, time to take the bottles out of the house, you know, or maybe it's something more significant than that.
Exactly. And you're reminding me of tip number five, which is the 5 second circuit breaker, which really helped me. So when I thought, when I went back to the thought before the thought that said I need a drink and realized it is about stress, I literally put my hand on my heart to reconnect with my body, because all of that talk is up in your head. And I was trained as a dancer, so I had always been connected with my body, but all of this writing and drinking and everything else put me into the cold attic of my mind. I needed to reconnect with my body. And so I would take a breath and just say, okay, if that's what this is right now, could I do something different just for 5 minutes and see if that I need a drink is still there? So I'd go for a short walk, get into any piece of nature I could, forest bathing, a la Japanese. I love that concept of healing through nature. Take a bath, watch a show. I mean, there's all kinds of things. You find your own thing, but it doesn't take long. You know, like it's almost like just that, as I say, a 5 second circuit breaker, just change your energy, change your environment, get out of where you're stewing about this. I need a drink. I need a drink. Get outside or whatever you can do that works for you. And that really helped a lot too.
Ooh, that's a wildly powerful one.
Yeah, good.
So good.
Glad
so
you
good.
Like it.
So let's get into, actually, before we wrap up the sort of this part of the interview, tell me what the most contemporary recommendation is for safe levels of drinking. I don't know what if there's a better terminology for it. Talk about that a little bit, please.
There is so much confusion out there, and it's causing undue anxiety and worry among women and others about, well, what is moderation? There have been studies that have come out that say no amount of alcohol is safe, but you always need to examine, and I'm sure you're very well aware of this, Fiona, who's sponsoring the study? How was the research done? Are the statistics relative or absolute? Because there's been a lot of twisted stuff out there. So one of the studies said nothing. You can't drink anything. Any level is unsafe, which is enough to drive me to drink. It's like, what? I can't do that. Yep. Help me. So that study was sponsored by an organization whose goal is abstinence, zero tolerance for various reasons. And I won't go down the rabbit hole, but you have to really monitor, where's the advice coming from? In Canada, Health Canada has not changed its guidelines since 2011, despite all of these studies. And its recommendations remain 1 to 2 glasses a day for women, max, 2 to 3 for men, or 7 to 14, respectively, for women per week, 14 to 21 for men. And no session, no one, you can't save them all up for Friday night and have your 7 to 14 all on Friday night. They do not recommend starting to drink if you don't drink. So all of that is kind of the guidelines. And then people say, but what do you drink? And I'm happy to share always what my intake is. And I choose most weeks not to drink for 4 nights a week. And then my partner and I usually go out to a restaurant 1 or 2 nights a week because we love dining out. It's our family sport. So on those nights, I'll have 2, max 3 glasses. The other night where he's cooking, he cooks, I pull corks. I'll have wine that night too.
Sounds like the AGM platinum model.
Oh, I know. I called him Cinderfella. He didn't like that any more than Buzz Killington. Anyway,
that's glorious.
You can't put that in the book. I said, I have to. Come on. So I end up netting out at about, 6, 8, 9 drinks max per week. I'm okay with that because I also say, like, I do the trade-off in my mind. Wine is part of my own culture. It's part of the way I commune with people around a dinner table. It's food pairing. It's part of my social well-being. And it's my job. But apart from that, I could still actually do my job and just spit everything. Expectorate, I should say. So that's where I netted out. People have to make their own decisions, of course, what they can tolerate, what they can't, what they're willing to do for trade-offs. But my therapist added something helpful to me in deciding, because I said to her at one point, should I just go sober? My father was an alcoholic. And alcoholism runs on both sides of my family. You know, my Celtic relatives find it amusing that the moth likes to fly very close to the flame. You know, she writes about wine. That's but you said, no, I think that would be punitive in your case. Again, everybody's individualistic. Let's try harm reduction first. She said, in my experience, when people just try to go cold turkey, it often fails, or there's a rebound or whatever. Let's try for harm reduction. Harm reduction means you're drinking too much. Let's acknowledge that. And let's see if we can get you down to a level that is moderate. And the most benefit comes from going from excess to moderate. From moderate to zero, sure, there's probably still more health benefits, but not near as much as getting yourself from excess to moderate.
Thank you for sharing all of that. I just can
Sure.
feel the listeners who have wondered about these things but have the shame thing and don't know who to ask, or
Yeah.
don't know how to ask, or don't know who to ask. And so I think that has been,
Great.
it's going to be tremendously helpful for the listeners of the show. So thank you, Natalie, for sharing all that. Very vulnerable, and I appreciate it
Thank
very
you.
much.
Well, my pleasure. And women also email me and say, I've lied to my doctor all these years. I can't tell her how much I drink. And it's
Yes.
like, oh. Anyway, so I'm
Yeah.
hoping this gets them to a place where they can.
And you saying that is so interesting because I can tell the ones that are going to tell me when I ask again in when I've got a new patient and I ask that question, I can tell if they're telling me the truth or not,
Ha.
right?
Yes.
It's kind of a fascinating thing to watch. And of course, I have no attachment to it. And most people are doing just fine there, but we've just got a lot of shame around. Okay, here's what I want to
There
talk
is.
about next. So I love wine. And wine has not loved me since I've entered my perimenopause. I went from drinking reds. Now I can't drink reds. Now I'm to whites. And now I'm at the point where I actually pretty much abstain from all alcohol. I have a drink a quarter to remind myself how much it disrupts my sleep. But I very much miss the experience of wine drinking, the opening a fresh bottle, the different knowing most of the wines we drink in this house, we buy when we're in the Okanagan, right? So we love the Okanagan
Great.
wines.
Yes.
So for my American listeners, that's just north of Washington State. Yeah, closer to Idaho. But there's lovely wines in Washington State, I
Oh,
understand
there
too.
are.
So yes.
Absolutely.
So we've got these beautiful culture. We've got these great tiny little vineyards that have lovely people that, remember us every year when we go by and would take home a case of wine, sort of thing. I miss that experience. I love the viticulture. I love learning about wines. There's certainly been, I've t in times of my life, I'm like, should I go and take some classes or something? So I love
Yes.
it. And I miss that. So how, I hope that is my sleep is my primary issue in my
Yes.
perimenopause. I talk about it lots on the show, as you know.
Sure.
So I hope there comes a time where things settle down enough that I can have a glass of wine with dinner and not be disrupted in my sleep. But at this point, the answer is no. But so I want to hear if you have any thoughts on that, but also about these low alcohol or no alcohol wines. I've not tried any of them.
Ah, okay. Well,
So.
they've come a long way so far. So yeah, in terms of like the drinking during perimenopause, I mean, I've said in the book, and I continue to say, even though I'm sharing these tips and what worked for me, I am by no means a doctor like you are, Fiona, and so that it's not meant as medical advice. But I do know, alcohol and specifically wine reacts with many different people in many different ways. I mean, I have rosacea, so I'm not wearing any blush, but I'm pretty pink today already. And I haven't been into the Chardonnay. So, but alcohol is a, correct me if I'm using the wrong terms, vasodilator. It expands your capillaries. So if you're already a blusher or rosacea or anything, it's going to exacerbate that.
That's definitely me for sure.
Yeah, it's like,
Yeah,
I can't
us
run.
Northern European ancestry.
Oh, yeah, thank you. DNA.
I know, I can blame those buggers for celiac disease too. That's a drag.
Oh,
But
my
anyways,
goodness. Yes.
that's another show, Natalie.
That's another show, but we need to get to it. But yeah,
Yeah.
I often go in like to wine tastings and know, like, I'll put on like double layer of just ghostly makeup. And I'll still come out looking like a radioactive lobster. It's like, oh, and it feels like so, oh, can't
Yes.
control her drinking. Anyway, so it does that. What else does it do? Like some people, everybody's different, but some people react to the histamines in wine. So that will give you the congestion. Histamines can be in the the tannins from the oak that's used to age some wines. It can be tannins are also in the grape skins, the seeds, the stems. For the most part, wine is destemmed, but it can be in there. So you can be reacting to that. The one thing that I p think people overestimate is their reaction to sulfites, which are in all food and drink naturally, by the way. Even wine that says no sulfites or organic, which is, well, there's different limits by country, by region, but usually I think it's 100 parts per million. Even when they don't add sulfites, sulfites will be in your wine. But keep it in perspective in that there are more sulfites in one glass of orange juice on average than in an entire bottle of wine. So I think people think they're overreacting to sulfites, and maybe 5%, something like that, of the population are allergic to sulfites, but most of us are not responding to that. We're reacting to either drinking too much alcohol, that's what's giving you the headache, or maybe the histamines, the tannins, that sort of thing. So that's just some of the stuff in terms of the reaction, but we can talk about low and no alcohol wines.
Yes, please.
Okay. So these are not the sad, sorry cooking wines of 5 years ago. The market has exploded, probably in part egged on by the pandemic, perhaps when people were staying at home wanting alternatives. But there's such a move toward health. And there's so many trends now. You think about Sober Curious, Dry January. They're naming different months to do more dry trends. And they say Gen Z is drinking far less than their parents, moving away from wine. The wine industry is very worried, but all alcohol too. So a lot of those trends are driving the explosion in the number of different low and no alcohol wines that are coming onto the market. And so you have low alcohol wines, which can be made various ways. Either they've spun the alcohol out of it, out of the wine, or they don't let the grapes ripen as long as they usually do. And that works in cool climates, in zippy wines, fresh whites like Riesling, you'll often find has low alcohol. And by low, I mean maybe 7-8%. Average table wine is 12-13%. Warm climate wines like perhaps Australia can get up to 14-15%. I've seen some wines up at 17-18%. Port, fortified wine, port from Portugal is 19-20%. So you're really getting up there. So,
fortified is right.
oh, fortified. Yeah, they add grape must, sweet brandy
Oh,
grape
okay.
must, so that it referments and it gets you to that higher level of alcohol. It's a traditional method of making this dessert wine. Sherry is done the same way, slightly different process, but that's how you get fortified. It literally means it's been fortified, made to have that higher alcohol. It originated when you had to send port from Portugal to England because England was upset with France and fighting with them. So they had to get the wine had to last in the ship's hold and not go bad. So they fortified it and everyone developed a taste for this fortified wine. So that's one category, low alcohol naturally or spun out through a centrifuge or whatever. Then you have alcohol-free wines. Two methods. You can either spin out all of the alcohol, in which case these tend to be my preferred. So they make it like wine all the way, real wine grapes, real wine methods, maybe oak, maybe not oak. And then they remove the alcohol from it. It's called de-alcoholized. And then the other method is that they're making wine from grape concentrate, like it could be Chardonnay grapes, the concentrate, and then they're adding other things to build up the drink as wine, but it never had alcohol to start with. The reason I like de-alcoholized is that it follows a similar process. I think it tastes better. The intention of trying to make a wine, but without the alcohol, I think does create drinks of better quality. But that said, I review them all with, without, low, no on my site. And I've been just so pleased with the quality that now when I do TV segments like on CTV and so on, I always include an alcohol-free wine to be more inclusive and to recognize, not everyone drinks, of course. And you've got your designated drivers, you've got your people who are pregnant and have health issues or just don't want to drink. So it's about time that these wines came in full force with really good quality products.
And is it the wineries that we know and love that are making these wines, or are there dedicated wineries?
They tend right now to be dedicated wine, to be not the wineries themselves, but though more and more wineries, traditional wine producers are starting to make low and no alcohol wines because they see Gen Z and other their market is literally dying off. Like the wine as a market is on the decline. So if they're going to survive, they're going to have, I think, these wines in their portfolio. But I would say the majority of wines that I review are from specialty producers who are making either de-alcoholized or, alcohol-free from the beginning kind of wines and drinks.
So this is probably behind this movement of alcohol-free cocktails as well.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, you can get lots of mixed drinks. I tasted the other day a whiskey that was alcohol-free. They're making whiskey and bourbon and your
So
bourbon.
tell me, yes, exactly. Tell me what does the wine, is it the same on the palate? Like, talk to me about what the experience of that is.
It is not, but sparkling wines come pretty darn close. On the nose, if I'm swirling a glass of alcohol-free sparkling wine that's been really well made, because there's still crappy ones out there, and then one that does have alcohol, it's so close. I think you'd be hard-pressed to tell them apart. On the palate, alcohol gives a wine weight, body, texture, that sort of mouthfeel, just like French fries have that lovely fat and grease and
Yes.
everything else that we love, you know. You might even taste the difference between, say, a cake, maybe, I don't know, cake that has gluten, one that doesn't, or one that's made sugar-free and one that isn't. There's something that's a little different that's going on. But in the case of wine, with sparkling wines, because they have the bubbles and the effervescence, that really helps to make up for the absent body from no alcohol. And that's why I find them the best bets. Then after that, I go to white wines, especially zippy whites like Riesling, cool climate whites, Sauvignon Blanc. And then after that, I would go to rosé. And then after that, you're into reds, which are the hardest to really replicate. They don't have the acidity, natural acidity of whites that help the whites taste better. They don't have the bubbles of sparkling. So that's kind of, if you want to start tasting some no alcohol wines, start with bubbly if you like it, or a zippy white fresh wine. And you'll find that I think you'll fare better with those.
I'm over here grinning to myself because as you're making this list, I'm like, oh, she's describing the bitch pours. They're my favorites.
Oh, bitch pours, yeah.
I know it's a terrible term, but
Isn't
when I
it
read it,
terrible?
it
Yeah,
is. As soon as
women's
I'm,
wines, like
that's
quote unquote women's wine,
women's wines.
Prosecco, rosé, Pinot Grigio, all these simple, as opposed to the more complex sommelier selections of your artisanal Cabernet, and I almost go down an octave when I'm talking about them.
When you're talking about it,
It's so misogynistic.
it really is. And that's when I knew I was going to love your book because it was one of the first pages in the book. You talk about the bitch pours. And I was like, oh, those are my wines.
Yep. And that's what's been marketed to us. And there's nothing
Wow.
wrong with those wines either. They
Yes.
tend to be lighter, yes. It doesn't mean we're lightweight for enjoying them. They've been just, poo-pooed by wine snobs and so on. It's like, oh, you can't be serious with those wines. It's like, yeah, but you can have a lot of fun. And some of them are very well made. L lots of them, not some, lots of them are well made and should be taken just as seriously, so to speak, as your Cabernets and your Shirazes and so on.
It's something's just popped into my head that I didn't know was swimming around in there this whole time we were talking. But the first time I became very interested in the wine culture was watching someone I think is America's first female sommelier, which is Andrea Immer, right?
Oh,
Do you know
yes.
this on Oprah?
Yes.
In
Yeah.
the 90s, probably, maybe even the late 80s, and she had a book. And
Yes.
she was such an interesting person. And that's when I remember thinking, wow, there's like some, I don't, was I even drinking age then? Barely. Did it matter? I don't know.
Yeah,
But I know
she's
that
wonderful. Yeah, she's been
she
very
really is.
fundamental to people learning about wine, particularly in the US, but worldwide too. Yeah.
And thank you for your contribution through your wonderful books. They are so well written, and I consider myself so much better educated, certainly about the industry, but also about little wine things along the way.
Yeah, you know? It tried to drop those along the way, just like the tips on cutting back, but also tips on if you want to kind of learn a little bit about wine. My mother used to hide the peas in the mashed potatoes to try to get me to eat my vegetables. So even my two wine books previous to this one, I always tried to hide the wine education inside stories so that you don't feel like you're being educated.
Oh, I love that. I think that's a much better way to learn.
Yeah, and to eat, actually. Peas. I still don't like them.
And of all the vegetables, peas are usually the ones that are offensive, right?
I know, but you have to finish them if you're going to get dessert.
And that's how childhood trauma works in our world.
Exactly. No wonder I'm drinking too much Chardonnay. Mom! Exactly. Just kidding. I dedicated the book to her.
Yes, you did.
Wonderful.
You did. I saw that. So I have loved this conversation. It's been so far-reaching. I mean,
yes, absolutely.
How fun is that?
Imagine if we had a glass in front of us. Oh, we wouldn't be done till this evening sometime, I think.
Exactly. But here's the question I have. If you envision the two of us having this conversation in person, what wine would you pick for us?
Oh, well, you know, I do love a good rosé. Now, we could have a bourbon chaser if you need that, if you want that, I should say.
Natalie, excuse me, don't you know booze before wine makes you sick? Or no, beer before liquor makes you sicker, isn't that the term?
That's true. And candy is dandy, but liquor is quicker. But I would go with a lovely dry rosé from BC. Actually, I might open two bottles just to have a side-by-side comparison. And I'd have one from the Okanagan, one from Niagara. We could even throw one in from California for our American friends.
Yes, please.
Because nothing's more instructive than tasting wine side by side. It's what I do with my online course students. Because people always think, they raise the glass to their nose and they go, wow, it just smells like wine to me. And that's where we all start. But when you start taking a sniff and a sip of, say, two or three wines, and you just need an ounce or two in each glass, you don't have to overdrink, and the differences will pop right out at you. So we'd have a rosé or two or three, and then I still like the idea of a bourbon chaser.
Ooh, my mouth is watering.
Good, I've done my job.
Perfect. I've learned so much from you today, Natalie. Thank you so much.
Fiona. And I am learning so much from you and your podcast. So please, thank you, and keep doing all that you do for middle-aged women and all of those who live with us.
Exactly, right?
Yeah.
So tell my listeners, please, where they can find out more about you and your work.
Sure. Thank you. So it's... the website is my name, nataliemclean.com, which is very easy to misspell. So if you prefer, winewitchonfire.com, which is the book title, and that's witch with a W-I-T-C-H. So winewitchonfire.com, and you can find, I have free bonuses for anybody who buys the book, including some online tastings and signed book plates. And you can get the free book club guide. You don't even have to have a book club to get this free guide. I found it was interesting. Partners, spouses have been reading it, and they're reading the book, and then they use the guide because it asks questions, many of which we've explored here today. How do you feel about your relationship with alcohol? Do you think social media is still a good place to be? How is wine marketed to men versus women, and so on? So it really sparks a lot of discussion, whether it's a book club, friends, partner, spouse, and so on, all at winewitchonfire.com.
Amazing. And where can people find you on social media?
I'm on all the places, usually at Natalie McLean. Sometimes it's at Natalie McLean Wine, if someone got there with my name first. And you'll find all the links to my social media at nataliemclean.com or winewitchonfire.com.
Perfect. I ask all of my guests the last question, I should say. Okay. So you are aware of what the last question is if you listen to the show. And it goes like this. Knowing what you know now, what would you tell your younger self?
I'd say, it's all right, hon. You've got this. And you know, Fiona, I think a memoir is a hug for your younger self when you thought you were alone, but really, you are the one you've been waiting for, and you were there all along.
I love that. So good. And this is what reading the book is like, folks. Wine
Oh,
Witch on
thank you.
Fire by Natalie McClain. Please read it. Natalie, thank you so much for your time and your
Thank you.
wisdom today.
Oh,
Thank
thank
you.
you, Fiona. Thank you as well. Cheers.
Take care.
Okay.
The information and other content provided in this show, or in any linked materials, is not intended and should not be construed as medical advice, nor is the information a substitute for professional medical expertise or treatment. We are doctors, but we aren't your doctor. Seek your doctor's opinion. If you or any other person has a medical concern, you should consult with your healthcare provider or seek other professional medical treatment. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something that you have heard in this podcast or in any linked materials. If you think you may have a medical emergency, call your doctor or emergency services immediately. The opinions and views expressed on this page and in this show have no relation to those of any academic, hospital, health practice, or other institution. Thank you.